The tour content from now through Pesach has been sponsored by the Kofsky family in loving memory of Adira, who loved big ideas and asking big questions.
Okay, so before we start, reminder that this is called Chumash Exploration and not Chumash Shir, because I can't guarantee ideas, okay? I'm going to state what the objective is of this, and it's going to seem extremely huge. And then we're going to narrow it. And then I think the Rav is going to expand it more, because that's my last minute addition. I actually have the Rav over here. Oh. We'll save him for later. Okay, so the stated objective of the Shir basically is like, how are we supposed to respond to bad things that happen to us?
That's funny. I had a question in the opposite.
Yeah.
I feel like I said, like, general Mahakam in that regard.
Yeah.
I don't know how you're supposed to respond to Tzadik.
Yeah, it's funny. Similarly, in the question of Tzadik Varalo and Rosh Hashanah Tovlo, people focus way more on Tzadik Varalo than on Rosh Hashanah Tovlo. Yeah, they do go together. Right. So this might shed light on that question also. At least according to one of the Mepharshim, we do. Okay.
Well, isn't it obvious that something bad's happening to you? It's because Satan and God are arguing about it.
That is the answer, Neo. Right? You don't need to read past the sixth pasuk. Yeah. Yeah, that's funny. The answer is it's true, if you understand that allegory. But So that's where I'm kind of drawing the line. That obviously the book that deals with this question at length is Eov. And obviously whatever we do here is not going to be covering the entire scope. But what I want to do here, and the reason why I say this is going to narrow the scope, is I wanted to look at this question through two specific examples of it in last week's Parsha and this week's Parsha, through the eyes of the Mepharshim. And I want to see if we can like skirt this line of, can we get ideas just from these two incidents without feeling like we have to tackle the entire sugya to get them. Okay. But then the Rav in this book that I'm reading like this week is going to like universalize it again at the end. Okay. So that's kind of the sketch. Okay. So we'll see what we get. Okay. So the sugya we're starting off with is in last week's Parsha, which is Vayeshev, right? That was last week.
Yeah.
This week is Miketz. Okay, fine. Yeah. So this is Bereishis Lamedtes. We're only going to be Pesukim Vav through Zion. This is the Eishes Potiphar thing. Okay. So the setting is Yosef rises in the house of Potiphar, everything's successful. And then Pasuk Vav says, Vayazov kol asher lo biad Yosef. So Potiphar gave over everything into the hand of Yosef. V'lo yada im ito m'uma ki'im halecham asher hu ochel. And he didn't know with him anything except for the bread that he ate. Okay. What's pshat in that?
In the bread part?
Yeah, the bread part.
The bread part, Rashi says is Potiphar's wife.
So Rashi says it's Potiphar's wife, basically that he entrusted Yosef with everything except for his wife. And the reason why he says that is because he uses a similar phrase later on when Yosef is arguing with Potiphar's wife and he says, like, the only thing that he has not given me is you, you know, or whatever. The only thing that he, whatever. Okay, but
Rashi says it's a
Dibor Lashon Nikir. No, right, it's a euphemism, right? So Avraham and Rambam says, what it means is Yosef was in charge of everything in the house, except Potiphar like handles his own food or whatever, you know, and some people want to say that that's because the Egyptians had this thing with eating with the Hebrews, right. Whatever. Okay. We're not going to get into that. Just want to go over shot. Okay. So then it says like this, but he, Yosef, you face or you face more. And Yosef was beautiful in form and beautiful in appearance. Okay. Then, Vaihi Achar Hadvarim Ha'ele, and it was after these things, Batisa Eshes Adonath Es Eineha, that the wife of his master lifted her eyes, El Yosef, towards Yosef, Batomer Shifa Imi, and she said, sleep with me. Okay, and then it goes through the whole seduction thing. Okay, yeah. So, this whole thing started off with me reading the Rashi, and I think in your source sheet it's reversed. Okay, I put Avraham Rang and then Rashi. So, let's start off with the Rashi, and I feel like this is a known thing. Okay. So Rashi says, Vahi Yosef, you face our vifim are, and Yosef was beautiful in form and beautiful of appearance. Kaven Shira Atma Moshe, once he saw himself like in the position of power, Hischil Ochel Vashosa Umasalso Bisearo. He began eating and drinking and combing his hair, literally smoothing his hair. I was wondering if it was a thing like he had a Jufro and he like got his hair straightened. I don't know if that was like a thing that they did in Egypt, because Masazo literally means to smooth out, you know, whatever. He started like pampering, you know, like fussing with his appearance. Amar Kadosh Baruch Hu. So God said, Avicha Misabel v'ata Masalsa v'sarecha, your father is in mourning and you're combing your hair. Ani Magare b'cha es hadov. I'm going to send the bear at you. I don't know why it calls her a bear. Okay. Miad, immediately, Vatisa Eshes Adonav v'gomer. So immediately she lifted her eyes towards him. Okay. So according to Rashi, he was like, this was going to his head and it affected his head, you know, and then that's what do you call it? Got her to notice him. Okay. But what question is Rashi responding to here? Like, what's bothering Rashi that forces him to say this?
I'd assume what's the connection between the two psukim, I guess.
Okay. So one is, you can say, what's the connection between the two psukim? Yeah. I think that's the question that Rashi is responding to, is why does it mention here that Yosef was handsome, right? Now there's a very simple answer to why it mentions here that Yosef is handsome.
No.
Because now it's relevant. Okay. Right. So if you look at Avraham ben Rambam, Avraham ben Rambam says, "He Yosef yifei sa'ar v'gomer in tamo kizen nischadish lo beves Adonav." The meaning is not that this like was a new state that occurred in the house of his master. Ella zehaya matavo hativi. This was his natural state, right? He was born handsome. Okay, no, he was naturally handsome. And they connected to usage of that phrase.
Oh,
Rachel, right? She was Yafa Tor Yafa Mar'e or whatever.
Yeah, it's the
same phrase, right? So they say he took after his mother. Ulefi Shaloh Hiskir Bo Ezze Lifnechtein Hiskir Khan. And the reason why I didn't mention this beforehand, and it did mention it here, Kde Lavar Esasibash Niskaka Lo Eshes Adonav, is to explain the reason why his wife took notice of him. Yeah. Yeah, right. Correct, right. It's not that she suddenly became beautiful.
Right.
Right. Exactly. Right. Now I think that this is plain pshat, right? I don't think I think it's more of a forced read to say that like he suddenly became beautiful and like to posit that he started like, you know, messing with his appearance. There are some, by the way, who want to say, I think it was the Poor Shore, who want to say he became handsome and beautiful, but not that he like did himself up. It was that basically, you know, when he got sold to Mitzrayim, he was in a state of like depression and like mourning over losing his family. And so he like looked ugly, but then as he got like used to the norm, then like his appearance returned, you know? So they're not blaming him, but they're like saying that it was just over time. Yeah.
Doesn't Rashi say like even earlier on, he was only...
Right. So yeah, when he was a youth. Right. Exactly. Yeah. It is interesting that it is, I guess, a trend of his. Right. But this sounds like a different kind of beautifying himself. That sounds like just like a youthful being into his looks. This sounds like a social prominence thing, because this came in Shara'a Atmo Moshe. Once he saw himself as a ruler, you know, like he's prominent in the house, then he started to like care about his looks. So it might be like just a further, I don't want to call it a development, you know, I don't mean development in a positive way. I mean, like it's a further.
It's a natural development though. Like,
yeah.
Progression,
right. I mean, he already cares about his appearance, right. And it manifests itself in this new way here. Yeah.
I think that would just make sense though. Cause you know, like if he wants to command respect, he can't just be this like
right
guy. And as the master servant of the house, you know, like,
right. So were you saying that, Ellie, because you're saying that it is consistent with the pshat?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's true if you hold that the beautification thing earlier on is the pshat, right? Because that's also like, you know.
I don't know. I mean, this one, you're a different thing to invite in the public.
Right. So there is one thing you can. So if you said that the Nahr thing, beautifying himself, is pshat, then you could say that this is somewhat in line with the pshat. But it's not like pshat, right? This is like Rashi pshat. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can also say, and I don't know enough grammar to say this. I've heard, in fact, we did this in the Kain and Hevel Shir, that I think Vayehi means he became. Vayehi Yosef Yifesor Yifemare, as opposed to Vahaya Yosef Yifesor Yifemare. But Avraham Aminrahman doesn't accept that, and he's in, you know, he's a chop shot guy. So I don't know if that's like a solid thing. Okay, but now once I was looking at Avraham Aminrahman, I noticed something else. Okay, next thing, Umamaro Patisa Ishas Adonaves Eneha, when it says that the wife of his master lifted her eyes, Hainu Shigavra Ta'avasa Elav. It means that her taiva overpowered itself towards him. Okay. Asher Bishvila Haisa Mchazeres Lihistakelbo Avur Yofio, that she would like try to find excuses to check him out, to check out his beauty. Okay. Lo Shumuvan Ze Shahi Lo Ra'as Oso Livnekein. This does not mean that she didn't see him beforehand. Okay. So according to Rashi, why does it say that she lifted her eyes to see him?
Because he was in a different state of handsomeness.
Yeah, is that he actually made himself look different, and that's what made her notice him. This is just that her taiva overpowered her. Okay. And if you actually, there's another Avraham Aminrahman that is not on your source sheet. There's a whole graveyard of abandoned shirim that I have that didn't work out. So this was one of them. So this was part of the other shir. So her taiva overpowered her. And then when he says to her, lo chasach mimeni mu'uma, that your husband hasn't withheld anything from me, he says, ein ta moshe mana oso mizev, he's here oso alze. It doesn't mean that Potiphar warned him explicitly about not getting with his wife. Elatam moshe kin aso alze yidua. Rather, it means that his jealousy on behalf of his own wife was known. Afbishal appear to Osa, even though he hadn't explained it. Shari Hasecha v'hatava v'hachok moni mizeh, that intellect and nature and custom prevent him from this. And I actually, even this is a different Avraham Aminrahman. Avraham Aminrahman goes on and says basically that she was being very, very like irrationally forward with her advances, mm-hmm. that she was demanding it bapet, like she was saying sleep with me, which is like violating like even their standards of snius or whatever. And she was the fact that she was interested in a slave was also like a big no-no. I guess it wasn't like American slavery where like masters, I don't know if in American slavery, I don't think mistresses slept with the slaves, right? I've never heard that was a thing. I don't know. At least it's not as known as the other thing.
So it's fine.
Yeah, right. So here's what intrigued me, okay? According to Avraham ben Rambam, Yosef is never portrayed as being at fault. Okay. Mm-hmm. He's just there. He's just naturally handsome. And she just her taiva overpowers her, and she goes after him, and he tries to resist her advances. Okay. According to Rashi, though, he was at fault for this because he was interested in his appearance. And it seems like there's also a criticism here of the way he's reacting to his father's mourning. Right, Avicha Mis Abel, which is a whole other sugya that I took up and abandoned because I couldn't find anything solid for a shir, is like, why didn't he send message to his father that he was still alive? Yeah, that's the whole thing that people take out. Like some say, like, oh, he knew that in order for the dreams to come true, then like he had to, whatever. That's a whole thing, you know. But Rashi's not the only one who says this. There's a whole genre of midrashim that the Nesiv quotes a midrash that. Basically, that Yosef. Doesn't that presuppose that Yosef
knew that
So, I guess the word misabel might say that, but he surely knows that Yaakov is wondering what suddenly happened to my only son. You know, like there's some insensitivity to his father. Okay, that could be. Yeah, that's true. Right, but I don't know. Like send word at least, you know. Okay, whatever. So there's a midrash of the Nesiv quotes, which I didn't bring here because. That's a whole other issue, right? What did the brothers know and what didn't they know?
Right.
Yeah.
Dead.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so John Tsukum's not so clear who sold him and who knew about it. And in fact, in this week's part, yeah. All right, whatever. That's a whole other subject. I didn't post that in this chat, I guess. Okay, yeah, I'll have to post it. Yeah.
I'm like,
a lot of chats going on. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I had a whole thing with everybody's airing last year on that.
Okay, yeah. So anyway, so there's a midrash that the Nitziv quotes that says that Yosef was neglectful of his Torah, and if he had learned Torah during this time, then he wouldn't have attracted he wouldn't have gotten to this whole mess with Asius Potiphar. There's another midrash that says that he was boasting about the fact. He says, my grandfather had a Nisayon and my father had a Nisayon, but I haven't had a Nisayon. And God says, oh, you want a Nisayon? And then he sent Asius Potiphar.
He's not a prisoner, right?
Yeah. Right. Then there's another midrash that says basically that that he was publicly flaunting his looks.
Yeah. Walk around.
Right. So this Rashi is a stand-in for all those midrashim. Right. Okay. There are midrashim who say that he was at fault for this, and then you have the pshat mefarshim like Avraham and Ramam who basically say no, like she came after him and like he wasn't at fault. And then I saw the Radak, okay? And the Radak is just coming out of left field. And this is not the Radak that I know, okay? You'll see what he says, all right? He says like this, Vayhi achar hadvarim ha'ele. Achar zman, at a later time, Shai Yosef v'beis ha'mitri, when Yosef was in the house of the Egyptian, Gadol v'nechba, and he was prominent, V'yoshev levetach, and he was sitting securely, Hiyukizehu dvar eshes Potiphar. So the matter of eshes Potiphar was incited against him. V'hakol hayasiba l'tobaso u'l'tobas aviv v'echav. And this ended up being for his good, and for the good of his father, and the good of his brothers. Afal pi shaya kasha mitchila l'tova haya basof. Even though it was harsh at first, it ended up being good. Same thing with the sin of the cupbearer and the baker and the dream of Paro. Hakol hayasiba me'esakel yisparach ki aide kolze ala Yosef l'gedula. I think I'm supposed to say l'gedula. That all of this was arranged by God so that Yosef would arise to prominence. Okay, now he says two reasons why the story was written. One, v'nichtav hasipur hazeh lehodia sibas hadavarim. This was the story was written to make known the causes of these matters. And I think this is part of the same reason. V'im yikra la'adam shum mikra, if some chance occurrence occurs to a person, yivtach bakel, he should trust in God, v'yeda shesofu l'tov, and know that it's going to end up being good. Okay? So this is like a gamzu l'tova idea, right? Now, the problem with that is, yeah, in Yosef's case, he had a nevuah that said he was going to become prominent. You know, and he was under the hashgacha, and this was like, you know, in the realm of the avos. So, like, is this really true of every mikra that you know you should think that's going to end up being for your good? I mean, that's not my when I say this is not the radak that I know. This is that there might be some sects of Judaism that hold that, you know, that everything that happens to you is for your good. That's not what we hold. In terms of, by we, I mean the Rishonim, you know, like that everything is for your good, you know? And yeah, there's a story of Nachum Ishgamzu, but like that has to be understood also, you know? It's a story, I'm not gonna tell the story. Tell the story. It's just not gonna be funny to anyone other than people who know Rabbi Fox. So someday you'll hear Rabbi Fox. Rabbi Fox was my high school Rebbe, thick Pittsburgh accent and also like a kind of idiosyncratic accent. So he, you know, he was in yeshiva in the early days, and it's always fun to see people who were in yeshiva in the early days. This was back when Rebbe used to give shir on Shabbos, every Shabbos. So, you know, people revere Rebbe, okay? But people who were like in the early days of yeshiva, when Rebbe was like a high school Rebbe to them, you know, not literally, but, you know, they don't have that same like reverence. They talk to him like they talk to their high school, you know, Rebbe, you know? So Rabbi Fox would like speak to Rebbe in a very like almost like a chavrusa type manner, you know? So they were arguing about this point, and like Rebbe was trying to give a svara based on this difficult, like, I think it was a Ruchaim, it was a long time ago, you know, and Rabbi Fox was saying how that Rebbe svara just doesn't make any sense, you know? So Rebbe, like, they're going back and forth, and then finally, like, Rebbe says, but there's another, I think it was another Ruchaim or something like that, where like, he gives a similar svara, you know? And Rebbe was bringing it as a raya. And Rabbi Fox says, great. Now there are two things I don't understand, you know, you know, so like, you know, person can point to Nahum Ish Gamzu, but if you ever looked at that story, that's its own story, you know? So I'm not going to go to Nahum Ish Gamzu. And again, we don't bring proofs from Midrashim, but according to the way that my understanding of Hashgacha works is we don't say that every single chance occurrence that happens to a person, Mikra, is for their good, you know? That really would be true for people who are like on the level of the Avos, you know? Okay. Then he says something else, which I'm just going to read for the sake of completeness. He says, "V'nichtav gamkein lahodia tzidko shel Yosef v'shiyomar adam imeno lichbosh es yitzro shaloyata ledvar avera." This is also written to teach the righteousness of Yosef and to teach a person that he should control his yitzer and not incline him towards any matter of avera. V'lishmor emuna l'mish boteach bo, and to preserve the trust of someone who trusts in him. I think that's Potiphar. No matter who it is, v'lo yishaker bro, not lie again, lie to him. Okay, fine. So it's a moral lesson also. Okay. So now these three things is what I wanted to give Shiran last week, okay, which is like you have Rashi blaming Yosef and all the Midrashim. Then you have Avram and Ramam not blaming Yosef and the Psukim kind of read that way, like she just like was attracted to him. And you have the Radak saying everything that happens is for your good. Okay. And I want to see, like, what are we supposed to make of this? You know, so let's say something like this happens to you, you know, like, you know, you're working in, in someone's house and like, what was it? Well, it's not just it is Latov. Yeah. Oh, it's fine. Cause he said Latov the second time, but, the first time he says Latovas so, or Latovas aviv echa, which is more specific. Yeah. That's a very good question. I think this is going to be part of it. Right. Right. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So in context of the Radak, it does seem like it means that it ended up benefiting Aviv Echav and making Yosef get to prominence, you know? Right. But I think that your approach does have merit, which we'll see.
What's going back to adding the first little couple lines?
This part?
Not being good. So, I can just read, you know, like other two parakim of like Chumash and I know that, you know? Meaning like is he adding it in like a, and see that it was good because it all's well that ends well? Like,
one thing that this is.
Yeah, he's saying why the start of
this.
No. I'm saying the first like two sentences of that.
Of the entire Radak, the Achrasman. Yeah.
Like that whole thing. Like,
right.
Like I get it. Like it was bad at the beginning. It was and it gets better, right?
Yeah.
But what's he?
Yeah, it is weird, right? Because he puts the emphasis on the fact that Yosef had it good and he was secure, and then this happened and it was really harsh, and it ended up being good. Yeah, I don't know why he has to frame it that way.
He just seems to be consolidating the entire story in two lines to like tell us that like, don't worry guys, it ends well.
I think maybe he is explaining vayhi achar ha-dvarim ha'ele. What dvarim ha'ele? That things were going well. I think he's just responding to that. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So now let's switch gears for a second and go to this week's Parsha. Okay. Next page. This is after the brothers are accused of being spies and they are imprisoned. To think it over. Okay, then after 3 days, Vayomer Aleim Yosef, Vayom HaShlishi, Yosef said to them on the third day, Zosos Vichu, this is what you should do and live. As Elokim Ani Yareh, I fear God. Funny non sequitur there. Okay, Im Keni Matem, if you are truth tellers, right? That's Kenim, I think. Like Cain, like from the word Cain, like if you are thusers. Yeah. One of your brothers, let him be imprisoned in the prison house. And you guys go and bring provisions to the people who are starving in your house. And bring your younger brother to me. And your words will be verified. And you will not die. They shall do this. Is that they shall do this? Vayasuchin, and they did this? They did this, yeah. It's weird, though, because they didn't quite do it yet. What was it? Does sound like they did it, but...
No, and then
yeah, okay. Okay, fine. So that's just setting the stage. Here's the pasuk that I wanted to get to. V'yomru ish el achiv. Each one said to his brother, "Aval ashemi v'nachav." We are guilty, al achinu, for our brother, asher ra'inu tsaras nafsho, that we saw the affliction of his soul, b'hishchanano elenu, when he pleaded with us, v'lo shamanu, and we didn't listen to him. Al kain ba'a elenu hatsara hazos. Therefore, this tsara came to us. Okay. And there are
strong rain and kind of
exactly. It does sound like they're directly ascribing it to this Sarah, you know, and they make several other statements, which we're not going to go into tonight, but I put here just in case. Later on, when the money is returned to them, they say, Mazos asa elokim lana, what is this that God has done to us? Mm-hmm. And a lot of the mafarshim say that that is referring to the same type of thing. And then when the goblet is put in Binyamin's thing, then it says, God has found the sin of your servants, but we're just going to focus on the first thing. Okay. So, they said, that the tsar has come upon us. Okay. So I just want to give you a tour of some of the mafarshim. What is it that they saw that got them to know that this was a punishment? So they say different things. It's interesting. Rashbam says, Hatsara azos, mida kenegan mida. Okay, they saw this as measure for measure. Anachnu hishlachnuhu babor, we threw him into the pit. Vihine anachnu ne'asarim bebeis hashavi, and we are thrown into jail. Okay, so based on what happened to us, then that's how we know it's mida keneged mida.
Oh, interesting, because I don't know if the word that the pesukim use here when they get thrown in is bor, but I think when it talks about Yosef being thrown into jail, I think it uses the word bor also.
Here I think it sounds like he's saying beis hashavi.
I don't know if that just could be him saying like prison. I don't know if that's what the pesukim.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. Yeah, I feel like though if it did use the word bor, then Rashbam would say it. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So that's that. Rav Yosef Bechor Shor says an interesting one. Okay. Vaday also ha'avon ba'alanu hatzar. Okay. So now this question is like, how do they know it was for that avon? So he says, certainly on that sin, this tzar came to us. Shekeshem shekulanu pashanu yachad, just as we all sinned together, kacha pira'un ba'al kulanu yachad. So too, the punishment or the retribution came to all of us together. Shim haya ha'avon acher, if it was another iniquity, lo baha piran lekulanu shavet, we wouldn't have all suffered an equal punishment. She'in avonenu shavim, our sins are not equal. Ela ze ha'avon, this must be the sin, asinu kulanu b'shavet, which we all did equally.
That is, Panini would offer, like, how do you know that?
How does who know?
I don't know what Avonu that.
Yeah, but this was
the part. I mean,
Right, but it's interesting the way he says it, because he's saying here we participated in this avon together and we got punished all together equally. You know, so I don't think he's saying in terms of weight. I think he's saying in terms of like this was the group avon that we did and this is the group punishment that we got.
What's the way of saying? I mean, it sounds like the important thing that it's because and that's the only other one that would be the other one that wouldn't be the people who fight.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I'm happy with my reading. I'll give you another example of this. And you could just say that's nothing I don't understand. But, you know, but Rabbi Kiva's students, you know, it was one group that all was characterized by a certain avon and they all got punished. You know, so if you were in that group, and you and all your chaverim are getting the same punishment, and you know that you're all guilty for this thing, right. You wouldn't say, oh, it's because I, you know, did this private avon, you know? So that's Yosef Bechor Shor. The Radak says, Hisvadu es avonam, v'amru ish alachiv, kip avon Yosef ba'alahem zeh. So they confessed their sins, and they said, each one to his brother, that it was the avon of Yosef that this came to them. Ki sha'al lahem Yosef, ma shelo haya sho'el me'acherim. Okay, that Yosef, now this is not talking about Yosef as a kid in the pit. This is Yosef, like the Egyptian guy, asked them questions that he didn't ask others. Shehayu baim liknos hatvua, who came to buy produce. Ein ze ki'im avon gadol shehaya alehem. This is only because there must have been a great sin upon them. Vezei avon Yosef achihem. And this was the sin of Yosef, their brother. So he's saying it's based on the fact that they received an unusual treatment.
Now.
Yeah, right. As opposed to when they get
sorrow from earlier.
Yeah. Right. In other words, it seems like in the Pesukim, the thing that made them realize this now is when he summons Binyamin to come, you know, because they got in trouble 3 days earlier. That's what you're saying. Like, why didn't he, why didn't they have this reaction when they got interrogated?
Right.
Yeah. But it sounds like, though, that would have been bad, but then they only made the connection to the Yosef thing
when they
realized the Binyamin connection. Binyamin. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And then, so again, here we have just as examples, three models of, like, it seems like they're unanimous in saying that they recognize that this was from an Avon, but the methodology is not clear, right? Is it that the punishment that we receive reflects an element of our hate? Is it that the punishment was meted out in a way that indicates the hate? Or is it that something unusually bad happened and that, you know, that indicates that there was an unusual hate? Okay, but then the Radak comes in and he gives a different lesson than what he gave earlier about Yosef. He says, Alkin ba elin atzarazos lemanu b'sipur hazek ki kishetavot tzara la'adam roylo lefashbesh b'masav. So this teaches that when a tzara befalls a person, it is proper for him to analyze his actions, v'livdok ma haya hamase harash asa, and to check and investigate what was the bad thing that he did. V'shi yischarid alav, and he should regret it. V'yisvada lifnei akel, and confess before God. V'yivakash mimenu kapara, and ask for kapara. Now, this is different than what he said by Yosef, right? And it's funny because if you look back now at the Yosef thing, the Radak never said that it was because of a sin that he had, right? So it does seem like he has two, you know, like, well, I guess the question is like this: why doesn't the Radak apply the reasoning from this week's parsha to the Yosef incident? That was a tzara also. He got thrown in jail, you know? So why doesn't he say, like, oh, Yosef, why doesn't he take the midrashim that Yosef, you know, was to blame for this? Why doesn't he say that Yosef, like, why doesn't he criticize Yosef for, like, not doing tshuva? You know, so that's another thing I kind of want to understand is, like, it sounds like he's laying forth two principles here. One is when something harsh befalls you, you should say it's for the good. And then there's another thing, which is when a tzara befalls you, you should do tshuva. And I don't know, like,
maybe those are one of the same.
Also. And that's kind of what Chaim was saying when you said that for earlier, that that's what you should do. And maybe he is saying that, you know, yeah. It's just, he could have said it a little bit clearer.
Yeah.
Now, two more mafarshim here. Okay, here Avram ben Aram jumps in and does agree with this. Okay, that they were at fault. I mean, because the psukim say that Avram ben Aram says v'his vadusim alzeh, their confession about this, the emunasam, and their belief, kimashi gia alehim hu onesh al chatam, their belief that that which befell them was a punishment for their sin, matima le emuna shehi yerusha lehem es Avram alav shalom, it was an inheritance that is in accordance with a belief that is an inheritance from Abraham, shehu yis ale shofet kol haaretz, that God is the judge of all the earth. B'zeh yesh hachana v'charata v'kabalas hadas hadin aleihem. And in this, there is a hachana and charata and regret and an acceptance of the judgment of the din, of the sentence that was pronounced upon them. Okay, so he seems to be consistent with this approach. Okay, then you have two more. Okay, and these are our last two we're going to look at, and then we'll have to theorize here. Let's stop here for one second. Okay, so what is this saying? Like, let me put it this way: are we saying that when something bad happens to you, then, like, vadai, this is a punishment from God for a specific sin that you should be able to figure out? Or if we're not saying that, then what are we saying? You know, like, let's say when the Radak says you should do tshuva,
right.
Is that just like a generic?
I was kind of thinking that.
Yeah, right.
That, like, it's not necessarily a catalyst so specific to tshuva, but it's a catalyst to just inwardly retrospect that, or introspect.
Introspect, yeah.
And then
I am retrospect.
And right.
Right. Yeah.
And by doing so, like, you'll end up doing tshuva. Like,
right.
That'll come out of it. Whether it's the specific sin or whether it's, you know, just anything that you've done.
Right. So the funny thing about it, though, is that at least in the Por Shor and the Rashbam's approach, of the Mi'ak Mida thing,
right.
It does look like they're like looking for, like, I guess this is the question, right? Is the tzara that befalls you an impetus for tshuva, or is it like a message about the chate, you know?
Right. And I'll say the hardest thing about, I guess, saying the Radak as I was, is that the psukim, like the brothers say, like, I guess they don't really say it necessarily in a Mida K'neged Mida way.
Well, it's interesting, by the way, the thing that there are a lot of mafarshim that go into what they say.
Right.
So they say three things. Okay. Ashimi menachnu al achinu, asher ra'inu tsaras nafsho, v'hischanenu eleinu v'lo shamanu. So I think it was the Malbim who said that there were three things here. One is that he is our brother and we treated him in a non-brotherly way. The second one is that he had Sara and we were had achzarius towards that. And then the third thing is he pleaded to us and we didn't respond to his pleas. You know, some of Farshim want to bring from here, by the way, that this is a proof that they did not sell him because he didn't plead with that. Well, the difficulty is the pasuk doesn't actually record the pleas. We won't get dragged into that. Okay. So regarding this thing though, that it's a generic call to tshuva. Look at Rabbeinu Bachya Bachai, however you want to say this guy.
Is it the same person?
Well, there's the Ibn Pakuda one who wrote Hosea Vos, and that's not this one. This is a different one. And it seems like no one knows how to pronounce their names. No. Bachai, Bachya, Bahe.
Wait, so this one is the
this is the Chumash one.
So that's the very
Kabbalistic
one.
He is the very Kabbalistic one, yeah.
Very into Medrash Rabba.
Yeah, very much so, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Aval Shemi Menachnu Alchinu. Zer Derech HaTzadikim. This is the way of Tzadikim. Kishechotim, when they sin, modim b'davar, they admit it. Umatzdikim alehen es hadin. They are matzdik the din on them. Now, how do you translate, like, tzidduk hadin? Now, this phrase we throw around a lot.
Yeah.
Well, people use tzidduk hadin for, usually in the case of when a tragedy happens, you know? I think so. Yeah. Maybe it's just a. Okay. Fine. All right. So then we'll figure it out now.
Tzidduk hadin.
Yeah. What does it mean to be matzdik the din?
To be just in the judgment.
To see the justice in the din, or to justify the din. Okay. Yeah. To justify the din. I think it's probably the most literal translation here. Okay. Okay. In Shikazov, as it's written, Asham. Who Ashom Asham Lashem in Vayikra. I don't know what drasha he's referring to in that. I assume it's a drasha. V'derech harishayim shechotim v'omrim inen ochet. So the rishayim are the opposite. They sin and they say it was not a sin. Hushkazav asher konehen yehargun v'lo yeshamu. Okay, brings a pasuk from Zechariah. Al kein ba eleinu. Okay, so is this relevant or did I just copy this by mistake? Let me read this. Yeah. Pirusho. Al hanachon ba elenu. Oh, meaning al kain. It doesn't mean therefore. It means it was justified that this came upon us. The al hadin, and it was in line with justice. Miloshen kain benos tzlovcha dovros. So that does not mean thus the benos tzlovcha spoke. It means that they spoke correctly, like it was right. V'hine hitzdiko aleim es hadin. They justified the din upon themselves. Ki kasher lo chamlu alav. Kibir osam b'tsara snapsho, just that because they didn't have compassion on Yosef when they saw his anguish, ba'alahem hatsarazos, then the tsara came upon them, mita keneged mita. Right? You were not showing compassion on your brother, God's not going to show compassion on you.
I can almost see him going both ways with like how this is working.
Yeah.
On the one hand, he's saying it's mita keneged mita. On the other hand, he's saying they create the parallel.
Yeah.
It means if you make it mita keneged mita, like, oh, this is why I'm getting it, then it's X. But if you just say that, meaning, according to him, it seems like I could just say it has to do with any
chayt
I do.
Yeah, right, I mean, right. It sounds like as long as you're matzdik the din. Correct.
Also a method.
Correct. That's good. Yeah, both approaches are saying it's impetus teshuva, but can you use the sara as a method for diagnosing the chayt?
Right.
Is it diagnostic? You know. Yeah, and then what's the method of diagnosis?
Right.
You know, yeah. Okay, so one more of the Mefarshim, and then I want to go into the Rav. Okay, so background info here for the Rav Bag. Again, the style of the Rav Bag. You listen to the Sunday Shir, okay? But at the end of each parsha, he gives to'alos, which are lessons,
right.
And the to'alos are in three categories: mitzvos, midos, and deos. Right. By mitzvos, he means halacha; midos, he means ethics or like interpersonal conduct, and then deos, he means philosophical or metaphysical ideas. Okay, so note he is going to bring two to'alos from this pasuk. Okay, HaTo'eles HaTshi'i Hu B'Deos. The first one is in metaphysics. V'hu L'Hodia, and this is to teach us, She'Hashem Yis'ala Ya'anosh HaTovim Alma She'asuhu Mi'apulus HaMagunas. Yeah? Yeah, Deos is ideas. You know, it's metaphysics, it's science, it's philosophy. Okay. Yeah, not Deus like Ramam Deus. It's confusing. Yeah, it's confusing. Always have to get the terminology clear. So this is to teach us that Hashem punishes those who are good for the despicable actions that they do. So for this reason, the Bnei Yaakov ascribed the bad occurrence that happened to them to their evil actions with regards to Yosef. Okay, so that's a philosophical thing. You see from here, when they got they suffered bad, they ascribed it to God. Okay, but then the next lesson, HaTolas HaAsiri Hu B'Midos. The 10th lesson is in Midos. Vihu, namely, Shiroi Lashalim, it is befitting of a perfected person, Shayatstik Alav Eshadin, Bevo Alav Hara'a, that a perfected person should justify the din when a bad thing befalls him. Viafashfish Bamasav, and he should investigate his actions, Viyaches Osa Laroa Masav, and he should ascribe it to the badness of his actions. V'lo yisra'im al Hashem yis'ale b'havio alav mashiyavi min hara. And he should not complain against Hashem when Hashem brings upon him this ra. U'lizeh timsa shi yachsu b'nei Yaakov mashi shepagsham mehara l'roa ma'aseim b'inyan Yosef. And for this reason, then the b'nei Yaakov ascribed the ra that they suffered to their own, to Hashem because of their bad actions. So isn't this a little weird? He brings this down as a metaphysical truth that God punishes those who are bad. And he says, and that's why they ascribed it to God. But then he also says that for Midos, you should justify the din and be mafashvish in your actions and do tshuva, you know? I mean, isn't it weird he divides this into two different to'alos? It should be one to'alos. Yeah. And so he even ends in the same way. And that's why they ascribed it to the evil of their actions. And herein lies, I think, the answer. Wait, Lodima. Yanosh Hatovim al. Was it? Who Lodia Sheshem Yisrael? Yanosh Hatovim al Mashiyasu Mehulus Magunos. Lizetim Sarshagvar Yiyachazu Bnei Yaakov Mashakarlem Mehara Laroa Masem Binyan Yosef. So no mention of tshuva there, right? That's just in saying that God punishes those who are evil for their evil actions, and that's why they ascribed it to Yosef. And then he says the second one is it's proper for the perfected person. It's also funny he says for the perfected person. Right? It's funny he throws that in. Isn't it right for everyone?
Well, no.
Okay, maybe I get it right. Anyway, so it's right for the perfect person to justify the din when something comes upon him and investigate his actions and ascribe it. Yayachas osa l'roa ma'asav and attribute it to his evil actions. L'roa ma'asav, his evil actions in general, it sounds like. So to me, it sounds like he's saying that you can't necessarily know what the specific fate is, but you should use it. He seems to be.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Right. Right.
But in terms of how you respond to that, you can't look at someone.
Okay. Good.
As a method not fate.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
You can't know that.
Good.
That's
right. Okay, good. So in other words, the first one is stating a reality. There are specific chataim that God is punishing you for. But when it comes to the practicality of the tshuva, yeah, you just have to do a general tshuva and investigate your actions. And you can't try to figure out like the why God is doing this. Yeah. Okay. Okay, good.
The first one telling us what's happening and yeah, telling us how we like interact with it.
Okay, good. All right. So this is a perfect segue into the Rav. Okay. Now. So have you ever heard of the Rav's, I don't know if you call it a book or a treatise of Kol Dodi Dofek?
Yes.
Yes. No. Okay. So it is, do you know what it's about?
I don't know.
Okay. So I knew it was about Israel. Okay. And like the Jewish people's response relationship to Israel. Okay. I'm going to do a little commercial break here. Okay. So I found out that one of my Facebook friends, was the translator for an edition of it. So I just like Googled it, $4. So I bought it. I was like, this is a good thing to read during Hanukkah. I started reading it on Monday and I finished it. Oh, I'm 2 pages away from the end today. Very short book. It's like, 70 pages ish. 95 pages. Okay, fine. So I think the last 25 pages are footnotes. I think, okay, right. So, you know, but, I am going to, advocate buying this if only for the first 11 pages, which we're going to read now. Okay. And I'll tell you why. I read this because the Rav wrote it apparently, I don't know. I think it was in 1959.
He wrote it?
The Rav wrote it in Hebrew. And then, Lawrence Kaplan translated it into English. I got to go on record saying this. He says that the publishers changed the title to Fate and Destiny as opposed to Kol Dodi Dofeg, which means the sound of my beloved knocking.
Yeah.
He said he didn't like, the translator said he didn't like the fact that they changed the title. You'll see why when we read this excerpt. But so I think the Rav wrote it because it was after the Holocaust, and he wrote it kind of as a tokacha to American Jews for the way that the lack of response to the Holocaust, and then not taking. Do you know the reference of Kol Dodi Dofeg? Like what that is referring to? Yeah.
Oh, it's like that. The two lovers are sending back and forth, and finally he comes, and she's out in bed. I have my pajamas on. I don't want to get out of bed.
Yeah.
And he knocks, then he leaves, and she goes to the door, and she sees that he's gone, and that's where everything goes down.
Exactly. So the Rav wanted to say that the Holocaust and the state of Israel is God knocking, mm-hmm. and like we are almost in the position where we're missing the opportunity to to take advantage of that. And, you know, and so it's a strong tokacha, and you need someone like the Rav to do this, you know, but so I'm reading this expecting it to be about that. The first 11 pages are about how to deal with suffering and evil in the world. Okay. And if you don't mind, I would like to read all the pages, all 11 pages, and we'll discuss as we read it.
Sure.
Okay. Cause I know I was going to go through and just like cherry pick like the relevant things, but trust me, hearing the Rav say it is pretty good. Okay. Okay. So again, and we can go ahead and now not all of this is going to be relevant, because there's a lot of like poetic Rav stuff they throws and other stuff, but we'll stop and talk about what's relevant, or if there's stuff we want to discuss, then we can do it. Okay. Yeah.
Translate it into understandable layman English or the Rav English?
I think the Rav's English. So, okay, here's what I can't figure out. I think this is the same translator who translated Halachic Man.
Oh.
Okay, it's funny. I gotta, you know, it's interesting. He didn't include his name in the entire publication here, which is like, it took me a while to verify that this is actually him, but I gotta check out Halachic Man later. Okay, anyway, so... one of the darkest enigmas, he always starts off in rough language, enigma. One of the darkest enigmas with which Judaism has struggled from the very dawn of its existence is the problem of suffering in the world. Already Moses, the master of the prophets, in a moment of mercy and grace of divine acceptance, pleaded with the Lord that he enlighten him concerning this obscure matter. Moses knocked at the gates of heaven and cried out, show me now thy ways that I may know thee, to the end that I may find grace in thy sight. Show me, I pray thee, thy glory. Right. And that's the Chazal saying that he was asking about Tzadik V'Ra'lo and Rasha V'Tov Lo. Why and wherefore do afflictions and pain befall man? Why and wherefore do the righteous suffer and the wicked prosper? By the way, I don't know where Chazal get that from, that's what Moshe was asking about, because he was asking about the Chet HaEgel. Right. Okay. From that wondrous morn when Moses, the faithful shepherd, communed with the creator of the world and sought a comprehensive solution to the question of questions, prophets and sages throughout all the generations have continued to grapple with it. Habakkuk demanded satisfaction for the affront to justice. Jeremiah, King David in his Psalms, and Kohelis pondered this quandary. The entire book of Job is devoted to this ancient and mysterious query, which still agitates and disturbs our world and demands an answer. Why has God allowed evil to reign over his creation? Okay. Judaism, in its strenuous endeavor to reach a safe shore in a world torn asunder by pain and affliction, in its search for an answer to the profound dilemma posed by the evil, which apparently reigns unboundedly, arrived at a new formulation and definition of the problem, possessed of both depth and breadth. The problem of suffering, Judaism claims, may be raised in two distinct dimensions, fate and destiny. Okay, that's the title of the book. Okay, fate and destiny. Judaism has always distinguished between an existence of fate and an existence of destiny, between the I subject to fate and the I endowed with destiny. It is in this distinction that our teaching regarding suffering is to be found. Now, he's going to go and explain both of these things together. Here he goes.
I don't know what that means.
He's going to explain. Okay. He's going to explain them together and you'll see why it's the same. Okay. Thank you. Okay. What is the nature of an existence of fate? It is an existence of compulsion, an existence of the type described by the Mishnah, against your will do you live out your life. A purely factual existence, one link in a mechanical chain, devoid of meaning, direction, purpose, but subject to the forces of the environment into which the individual has been cast by providence without any prior consultation. The eye of fate has the image of an object. An object he appears as made and not as maker. He is fashioned by his passive encounter with an objective external environment as one object vis-a-vis another object. The eye of fate is caught up in a blind, wholly external dynamic. His being is empty, lacking any inwardness, any independence, any selfhood. Indeed, an eye of fate is a contradiction in terms. For how can eye awareness and selfhood coexist with pure externality and object-like being? It is against this background that the experience of evil arises in all its terror. There are two stages to this fate-laden experience of evil. Now, spoiler alert, the Rav is critical of this. Okay, he's saying this is not the good approach. All right. To begin with, man, the object, bound in the chains of an existence of compulsion, stands perplexed and confused before that great mystery, suffering. Fate mocks him. His being, shattered and torn, contradicts itself and negates its own value and worth. The dread of annihilation seizes hold of him and crushes him, both body and soul. The sufferer, quaking and panic-stricken, wanders in the empty spaces of a world upon which the wrath and terror of God weigh heavily. His afflictions appear shadowy and murky, like satanic forces. There's your satanic reference there. The offspring of the chaos and the void which pollute the cosmos that had been destined to clearly reflect the image of its creator. In this stage of perplexity and speechlessness, of confusion of both mind and heart, the sufferer does not pose any questions about the cause and nature of evil. He suffers in silence, groaning under the weight of an agony that has stifled all complaint and suppressed all queries and inquiries. So in a word, stage one is you suffer and it's harsh and you're just kind of overwhelmed by the suffering. Okay. After the psychic upheaval of the sufferer, as immediate reaction to evil has passed, there follows the intellectual curiosity which endeavors to understand the cosmos and thereby undergird man's confidence and security. What do you call it? What's the word for the study of divine justice? Is that theodicy? Okay, thanks. So listen as we read this, how critical the Rav is of theodicy. Okay. I always have to cry, not the Iliad, not the companion to the Iliad, but the theodicy. In this stage, a person begins to contemplate suffering and to pose grave and difficult questions. He tracks the intellectual foundations of suffering and evil and seeks to find the harmony and balance between the affirmation and the negation and to blunt the sharp edge of the tension between the thesis, the good, and the antithesis, the bad in existence. As a result of the question and answer, problem and resolution, he formulates a metaphysics of evil wherewith he is able to reach an accommodation with evil, indeed to cover it up. The sufferer utilizes his capacity for an intellectual abstraction with which he was endowed by his creator to the point of self-deception, the denial of the existence of evil in the world. So he's basically saying you come up with you have evil, then you come up with a metaphysics whereby there is no evil.
Ooh, interesting. I've done that.
Yeah, I've done that too. Okay. And I find myself, just as a side note here, I'm torn between these two approaches because I don't know, like I've taught EO for a while and I've come to my understanding of this. However, my whole orientation towards Mishle and Stoicism is going to be what he's going to say next. So I'm kind of torn. Okay. Interesting. Okay. Judaism, with its realistic approach to man and his place in the world, understood that evil cannot be blurred or camouflaged, and that any attempt to downplay the extent of the contradiction and fragmentation to be found in reality will neither endow man with tranquility nor enable him to grasp the existential mystery. In other words, it doesn't work. You can't explain away evil.
You said evil exists.
Evil exists, and you can't explain it away. Yeah. Evil is an undeniable fact. There is evil. There is suffering. There are hellish torments in this world. Whoever wishes to delude himself by diverting his attention from the deep fissure in reality by romanticizing human existence is naught but a fool and a fantast. I've never seen that word before, a fantast, one who fantasizes. Yeah. It is impossible to overcome the hideousness of evil through philosophical speculative thought. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'll tell you an example of this. Okay. And this is like Bekitzer, you know, a huge part of the Rambam's answer in Iyov. Okay. Is Rambam says, if you look at all the ra in the world, there are only three types of ra. Okay. There is the ra that comes from the nature of physicality itself, right? So wood rots, people age, sicknesses occur, right?
It's like a law, entropy,
right? That's exactly right. Entropy is a physical thing, and he says if you want to be physical and not be subject to entropy, then you're living a contradiction, right? Okay. So he says, and if you look at the physical world, like those raos are very minute compared to the things that are not ra. For example, you will always have fewer people who have a sickness than people who are healthy. Things function well more than they function poorly, you know? And in nature, like there are more non-earthquake destruction times than like earthquake destruction, you know? So like it, as a whole, nature is good.
As a whole, homeostasis, it happens.
Yeah. Because if you understand all of it, you'll understand that it's all necessary for the maintenance of the system.
Ooh, have you read Mistborn trilogy?
No.
Okay, fine. Never mind.
Yeah. This is the whole all the problem in Rama about Eov, but I'm just giving you an example to address your point. Second type of ra is the ra that people cause to each other, okay, because God gave us free will, right? And the third type of ra, and he says, and that's more numerous, and the third type of ra is the ra we cause ourselves through our own bad decisions. Mm-hmm. Now, if you look at those things, the Rama is not denying evil, but what he's saying is, look, like, you're in a physical world, and this type of ra, the first type, is part of physicality. You can't have physicality without it. Second type of ra is because God created human beings with free will, and so is the third type. So what are you complaining about? You know, like, again, that's not the whole answer, but it's basically trying to say that like God, and this is after the parak where he says God doesn't do ra at all.
Right.
You know,
and evil and darkness, right? God didn't create.
Right. That. These are all things that come about incidentally, yeah. You know. So, and you go through the whole Rambam there, which is very important to go through in your life.
That, yeah.
Yeah, it's very, very good. If you want a walkthrough of it, read the essay called Divine Providence, Hopes and Fears. Hold on just a second. I've taught it too many years in a row. I need a break. I need to wait till I can approach it fresh. Yeah, this essay is I was just telling someone about this recently. Who was I telling about this? So this is Divine Providence, Goals, Hopes, and Fears by David Gutman. I don't know if I'm
36 pages.
Yeah. Okay, I'm saying this without exaggeration. Of things written by people nowadays, this feels like it's written with Ruach HaKodesh. Okay, I know that's huge. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. What he does is he basically goes through and walks you through the Rambam Shita on Hashgacha Pratis. And every time I've read it, it is like I'm reading a new essay and I get further and further clarity. And it's like a guide to the guide in that sense. It is masterfully written. And it sounds like all he's doing is basically just like excerpting Rambam and like giving you a little bit of explanation. It's fantastic. Maybe we should go through this on a Thursday as a Thursday night here. I haven't been to this in a while, and that can satisfy your Eov desire. Not this Thursday night, but I'm saying not this Thursday night, but you know, but okay, we could let's plan on doing that. Okay, that's yeah. All right, that sounds good. Anyway, but that's an example of what the Rav is talking about, is that you end up reading the Rambam and you're like, okay, fine, like I'm totally reconciled with evil, and like it makes sense that this evil is in the world and God's not doing it, and you know, so the Rav seems to be against all that. Okay,
he's against all.
Yeah, he's saying that you can't explain away evil, and it's an undeniable fact. And if you're trying to overcome the hideousness of evil through philosophical speculative thought, then you're just a fool and a fantast.
Well, Well, that seems to be like, if you're trying, that seems to be what the Rambam says with the first category of evil. First category of evil is that evil exists and that it's part of human.
Right. So I guess you could say that the Rav is not necessarily saying that about the Rambam, but I will tell you that like the emotional place that I end up after reading the Rambam is like what the Rav is criticizing. You know, we're like, what do you mean? Like, of course there has to be like, you know, this, and I also, I sometimes question whether I'm faking myself out, you know? Yeah. Okay. Therefore, Judaism determined that man, entrapped in the depths of a frozen, fate-laden existence, will seek in vain for the solution to the problem of evil within the framework of speculative thought, for he will never find it. Certainly, the testimony of the Torah that the cosmos is very good is true. However, this affirmation may be made only from the infinite perspective of the Creator. Finite man, with his partial vision, cannot uncover the absolute good in the cosmos. The contradiction in existence stands out clearly and cannot be negated. Evil, which can neither be explained nor comprehended, does exist. Only if man could grasp the world as a whole would he be able to gain a perspective on the essential nature of evil. However, as long as man's apprehension is limited and distorted, as long as he perceives only isolated fragments of the cosmic drama and the mighty epic of history, he remains unable to penetrate into the secret layer of suffering and evil. Yeah.
Is he in a roundabout way positing that if you were able to, then you wouldn't see it as evil?
Correct.
Okay.
So I think so. He is saying, and I think that's what he's saying, that if you saw the whole thing, right, like Moshe.
I thought that's what we were saying was a negative thing. Was a negative viewpoint.
No, it's negative if you try to do it. But he's saying that man left to his own devices can never succeed in that. Can never succeed in getting a philosophical, speculative.
No,
yeah, right, right.
So he's saying this is a positive thing to do, to recognize that if you did know it all, you'd know that it wasn't evil.
It's positive to recognize that, right? But he's saying that you can't actually be in that perspective.
Sure, sure.
And insofar as you try to think that you're in the perspective, you're faking yourself out on some level.
When
you know?
He
hasn't done that yet. He hasn't advocated for anything. He's going to do that in a second, okay? Yeah.
Meaning you should view the world as if evil does exist and yet know that it doesn't.
No, he's saying you should treat evil as though it does exist, because you're never going to see things from God's perspective. Okay, but what does he say you should do with evil? That he's going to say next. Okay, hold on, let's finish this paragraph. Okay, to what may the matter be compared? And by the way, I've always wanted to find a source for this mashal. Me too, but whoever came up with it, I can now say the Rav says it. Okay, to a person gazing at a beautiful rug, a true work of art, onto which an exquisite design has been woven, but looking at it from its reverse side, right? So I think we did this last time, right? Back of a tapestry, right? Google Images, if you haven't seen the back of a tapestry, right? So it's all ugly, right? I think we did in Tilim, yeah, right? So it's, I think I clicked on it and we also saw the Jeff Goldblum.
Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah, right, yeah. Yeah, all right, so, right, back of a tapestry is all chaotic, etc. And the Rav says, can such a viewing give rise to a sublime aesthetic experience like Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park? We at last view the world from its reverse side. We are therefore unable to grasp the all-encompassing framework of being. And it is only within that framework that it is possible to discern the divine plan, the essential nature of the divine actions.
Okay.
Yeah. He summarizes, in a word, the eye of fate asks a theoretical metaphysical question regarding evil, and this question has no answer. It is insoluble. Okay. Mm-mm. So now, what can we do with evil? That's what he's going to say now. In the second dimension of human existence, destiny, the problem of suffering assumes a new form. What is the nature of the existence of destiny? Now, by the way, destiny, he does not mean like a predetermined fate, like use destiny, okay? It is an active mode of existence, one wherein man confronts the environment into which he was thrown, possessed of an understanding of his uniqueness, of his special worth, of his freedom, and of his ability to struggle with his external circumstance without forfeiting either his independence or his selfhood. The motto of the Eye of Destiny is, against your will you are born, and against your will you die, but you live of your own free will. Man is born like an object, dies like an object, but possesses the ability to live like a subject, like a creator, an innovator who can impress his own individual seal upon his life and can extricate himself from a mechanical type of existence and enter into a creative, active mode of being. Man's task in the world, according to Judaism, is to transform fate into destiny, a passive existence into an active existence, an existence of compulsion, perplexity, and muteness into an existence replete with a powerful will, with resourcefulness, daring, and imagination. God's blessing to the work of his hands sums up their entire purpose in life. Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. Subdue the environment and subject it to your control. If you do not rule over it, it will subjugate you. Destiny bestows upon man a new rank in God's world. It presents him with a royal crown, and man becomes transformed into a partner with the Almighty in the act of creation. Pause for Naomi's question. Yeah, Naomi? Unless you hit that by mistake. I think you hit. Okay, there we go. All right. Yeah. All right. So he hasn't explained evil yet. He's just saying that man was created to be active and to take charge of his destiny. Okay, but now he says like this. As we have stated above, man's existence of destiny gives rise to an original approach to the problem of evil. For so long as a person grapples with the problem of evil while still living an existence of fate, his relationship to this problem expresses itself only in a theoretical philosophical approach. As a passive creature, the man of fate lacks the strength to struggle with evil in order to contain it or in order to utilize it to achieve an exalted goal. Starting to come clear? Yeah. For the I subject to fate is unable to effect any matter of consequence in the sphere of his own existence. He is nourished by his external environment, and his life bears the imprint of that environment. Therefore, he relates to evil from a non-practical standpoint and philosophizes about it from a purely speculative perspective. He wishes to deny the existence of evil and to create a harmonistic worldview. The end of such an effort can only be complete and total disillusionment. Evil derides the captive of fate and his fantasy about a world which is wholly good and wholly beautiful. However, in the realm of destiny, man recognizes the world as it is and does not wish to use harmonistic formulas in order to gloss over and conceal evil. The man of destiny is highly realistic and does not flinch from confronting evil face to face. His approach is an ethico-halachic one, halachic, devoid of the slightest speculative metaphysical coloration. When the man of destiny suffers, he says to himself, evil exists and I will neither deny it nor camouflage it with vain intellectual gymnastics. I am concerned about evil from a halakhic standpoint, like a person who wishes to know the deed which he shall do. I ask one simple question, what must the sufferer do so that he may live through his suffering? In this dimension, the center of gravity shifts from the causal and teleological aspect of evil, the only difference between causality and teleology being a directional one, to its practical aspect. Again, just plain English, teleology means the study of purpose, what the purpose of a thing is. Okay. So he's saying, in other words, what caused this to come about or what is this trying to accomplish? He's saying we're not concerned with that at all. Okay. The problem, or the man of destiny, is not concerned with that. The problem is now formulated in straightforward halakhic language and revolves about one's daily quotidian tasks. The fundamental question is, what obligation does suffering impose upon man? The question is greatly beloved by Judaism, and she has placed it at the very center of her world of thought. The halakha is concerned with this problem as it is concerned with other problems of permitted and forbidden, liability and exemption. We do not inquire about the hidden ways of the Almighty, but rather about the path wherein man shall walk when suffering strikes. We ask neither about the cause of evil nor about its purpose, but rather about how it might be mended and elevated. How shall a person act in a time of trouble? What ought a man to do so that he not perish in his afflictions? The halakhic answer to this question is very simple. Afflictions come to elevate a person, to purify and sanctify his spirit, to cleanse and purge it of the dross of superficiality and vulgarity, to refine his soul and to broaden his horizons. In a word, the function of suffering is to mend that which is flawed in an individual's personality.
It sounds like a positive thing.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
It is. Yes, this is the positive thing.
I guess I'm grappling with the difference between this and a fate man.
Okay, let's finish his description and then we'll summarize and talk about it. The halakha teaches that the sufferer commits a grave sin if he allows his trouble to go to waste and remain without meaning or purpose. Suffering occurs in the world in order to contribute something to man, in order that atonement be made for him, in order to redeem him from corruption, vulgarity, and depravity. From out of its midst, the sufferer must arise ennobled and refined, clean and pure. It is a time of agony unto Jacob, but out of it he shall be saved. I.e., from out of the very midst of the agony itself, he will attain eternal salvation. Yes, exactly. A phoenix raising itself from the ashes. Yeah, the agony itself will serve to form and shape his character so that he will thereby reach a level of exaltedness not possible in a world bereft of suffering. Out of the negation grows the affirmation. Out of the antithesis, the thesis blossoms forth. And out of the abrogation of reality, there emerges a new reality. The Torah, no one can write like the Rav. The Torah itself bears witness to man's powerful spiritual reaction to any trouble that may befall him when it states, in your distress, when all these things come upon you, and you shall return unto the Lord your God. Suffering imposes upon man the obligation to return to God in complete and wholehearted acceptance. Afflictions are designed to bestir us to repent. And what is repentance if not man's self-renewal and his supernal redemption? One more paragraph here, and then we'll stop. Woe unto the man whose suffering has not precipitated a spiritual crisis in the depths of his being, whose soul remains frozen and lacking forgiveness. Woe unto the sufferer if his heart is not inflamed by the fires of affliction, if his pangs do not kindle the lamp of the Lord that is within him. If a person allows his pains to wander about the vast empty spaces of the cosmos like blind, purposeless forces, then a grave indictment is drawn up against him for having frittered away his suffering. Okay, so in summary, okay, the man of fate, he's the way the Rav depicts him, is in a world where stuff happens to him. Are you smiling because of the preview voice?
Yeah.
I was thinking, in a world, right, where man is subject to external fate, and he basically tries to use his mind to philosophize a harmonious worldview where, like, evil has its place, evil is really serving the purposes of good and stuff. So then he's, number one, going to be trying to do something which the Rav says is impossible, because it's going to involve some denial of the evil, you know. Okay, and I'm just going to contrast it and you can ask your questions. And he's going to be passing up tremendous opportunities for growth. Yeah. But the man of destiny, who takes an active role, will not try to understand the cause of evil or the purpose of evil at all. He'll say, what can I do with this evil, right, in terms of my own transcendence and enlightenment and tshuva. And I heard this idea of the Rav expressed. I don't know if the Rav expressed it this way. I heard this quoted from Rabbi Zucker. I don't know what he was quoting, but that the Rav differentiated between the word madua and lama. We might talk about this in Talmud also. That when evil happens, we don't say madua. We don't say why. We say lama, which we translate as why, but lama means le ma, for what, right. Meaning we don't know the cause of why this is happening, but we can say, what can this be used for, and use it to perfect ourselves and to do tshuva and to get kapara and all this other stuff. So that's what the man of destiny does, where he takes active control, says, okay, I have this suffering. I'm not going to deny it. I'm even going to lean into it in order to figure out, how can I use this to perfect myself or to do tshuva, or use this as an opportunity for growth or for chesed or whatever. Yes, it is. Yeah. Against who, though?
I mean, against anyone who's in suffering.
Yeah. Meaning it's easier said than done, to be harif, or?
Yeah. It's very, like, in a very sharp way.
Yes. But see, this is what I meant when I said that, like, this appeals to the Stoic Jew in me, because this is all Stoicism, you know, right, of taking what happens to you and then using it, you know, the obstacle is the way, and you know, be fire, and fire takes everything that it encounters and uses as a fuel for its own existence, you know, Yeah, right. So I have an episode about the difference between be water, my friend, and be fire, my friend. You know, one's Bruce Lee, the other one's Marcus Aurelius, and what are the differences? It is harif, and it's a high bar, right?
It's a high bar, but at the same time, that is the whole point.
Yeah. It is, yeah.
If you're not in, then you're like missing the whole essence.
Exactly, yeah. You're frittering away your suffering. And what was the other term you used? That was really good there. And just wandering around the vast empty spaces of the cosmos like blind, purposeless forces. You know,
it's really hard. Like, it's a high bar, but if you're not in, then you're like you're not in.
Yeah, then you're an object. You're an object.
That's like Rousseau's idea in free will in general, though. Meaning, like, it seems like it's almost not quite word for word, but it's the same idea. Is that, like, where we all kind of start off as objects, and we eventually try to make ourselves God.
Right.
That's the idea.
Yeah.
He's going from Chesed to Gavra. That's like
the yeah, idea. Yeah. That's exactly what he says, right? Yeah. That is good. Yeah.
Well, one of my questions on it is that on page 8 in the top thingy, right? He says, "We do not require about the hidden ways of the Almighty, but rather about the path wherein man shall walk when suffering strikes."
Yeah.
Right? We ask neither about the cause of evil, nor about its purpose, rather how it might be amended and elevated. And then in the next paragraph, he says afflictions come. He almost says what they do, even though he says that we don't ask
for right.
the purpose. I think
he means, though, in a prescriptive way, not a descriptive way, meaning that we should relate to afflictions as we should use afflictions to elevate ourselves and to purify and sanctify the spirit. I don't think he's giving a theological.
Meaning he's saying that this is not necessarily why they're here.
Right. For all intents and purposes, this is what we should do with them. This is why they're here for our perspective.
So we're going to award it to Siemens and Rabach.
Yeah. Okay, good. So now this is why I think that this perfectly explains the Rabag, right? So the Rabag is saying, so the ninth toelis about Deus is the teleological metaphysical one, which is we know from Judaism, afflictions are there as punishment, but we can't access God's like cheshbon and God's mind and stuff. So in the realm of like trying to understand what this is a punishment for, we can't really do that.
Right.
But in the realm of Midos, in the 10th toelis, when suffering happens, when affliction happens to you, the perfected person should try to be matzdik the din, try to understand wherein lies the justice and the, like, in what sense do I deserve this? And in what sense can I be mefashmish my actions and do tshuva? And that is an ethical imperative. You know, that's why he puts it as a toelis in Midos, you know? And I think that that is why the Mefarshim who blame Yosef for this thing, you know, I don't think when Rashi says that he was, you know, making himself up, I don't think Rashi knows that for a fact. I think that the point of that midrash that Rashi's quoting is to say that, like, this is the derek that what you're supposed to do is if you're Yosef and you get thrown into prison, it might be entirely her fault, right? But you should ask yourself, like, am I doing anything that would make me deserving of this, you know? Like, have I been too into my looks and like letting this position of authority go into my head? Is this why God is doing this to me? I have no idea, you know? But you should generally like look at these things. And I think that you can even explain this with the Mida Keneg and Mida stuff, the people who do this with a particular thing, like, oh, we threw Yosef into a boar. You know, I don't think, I'd be hard pressed to say that like, they're making these statements as definitive things, like you're knowing God's mind, like why God did this. But the point is that you're using the framing device of Mida Keneged Mida to strengthen the reality of Schar V'Onesh and the reality of like you need to do tshuva, you know, in your mind. And it's like a method of getting yourself to do tshuva, which is the real point of this. It's not a metaphysical diagnosis. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, so like Norm is saying, it's the way of taking something which we can't interact with and interacting with it in a way that we know is not its actual form.
Yeah. And we know that there is an actual justice.
Right.
And everything is in line. But we can't see into God's mind.
Right.
You know, and we can see in our own mind, and we can look in our own actions, and then use that for tshuva. And I don't think this is a new idea. And I think we've all heard various forms of this idea. But I do think that for me, seeing it play out in the events in the Chumash does give it it strengthens it to see it in an example. And that when Yosef's brothers were saying like, oh, like, you know, Hashem Yimenachnu, and like, this is why God is doing this to us. I think it puts it in a much more realistic framework than them. Like, I used to think that they were like saying, oh, you know, this is part of the divine plan. Like, you know, I don't think that's what they're doing. I think like they're doing what the Rav and what the Radak and the Rabag are saying to do. And because we see it in the Chumash narrative and because we know about Yosef's dreams and we know how it turns out, then we do see how it fits into God's plan. But that's not what they were doing, you know?
Right. No, yeah, I was thinking about that also. Like, there's a couple factors that kind of, like, don't sit well with that. Like, one, obviously, they didn't know the conclusion. They didn't know anything about, like, who Yosef was or whatever. But two is that, like, granted, it would only take one of them to remember, but, like, someone would have to remember and, like, be like, oh, it's because we didn't listen to him when we were throwing him in the pit, you know, whatever, 20 years ago or whatever it was, you know?
I don't think it's that hard for them to remember it. I mean,
it also seems like they think of some halakha immediately.
Yeah, right.
Right.
And they certainly had conflicts that had to do with their father, and they know that their father has been mourning this whole time. So,
Yeah.
And I do think, by the way, that your initial intuition about the Radak on Yosef, about that this is for Latova.
Yeah.
I think, again, just my knowledge of the Radak, he's not saying this in a, like, this is coming for my benefit way. I think it is, like, in the Rav's way of, like, you should, you know, make this into something that is good. It's still, the Lushan makes me uncomfortable though, because he does seem to be saying it in a descriptive way.
Right.
But I think the fact that the Radak by Yosef's brothers says they should do tshuva and stuff like that, that seems to be the essential idea. Yeah.
So I put all what we're saying into the example that the Rav gives with the rug, and then I kind of came out with what Chaim said at the end of it. And basically, when you think about it, so it's recognizing that there's a tapestry.
Right.
It's recognizing that there's a back of a tapestry. It's recognizing that what we can interact with is the back of the tapestry. But the daunting part is what Chaim was saying, which is trying to make sense of something that doesn't make sense, basically.
And that's not daunting going to the Rav. That's impossible. Right.
No, meaning, because we're supposed to interact with the back of the rug, like the Rav was saying, right?
Right.
But the back of the rug doesn't really... It is chaotic, though. That's, I guess, the problem. That, like,
it is a chaotic thing. Right, but I think the analogy breaks down there, because the actual tapestry weaver is looking at the front of the rug in order to make the back of the rug. And we're not saying that you have to be seeing stuff from God's perspective in order to engage in the tshuva from our back of the rug perspective.
I think that's the difficult part. Is that we can't really even make sense of the back of the rug either in a sensible way. We have to just kind of like we were kind of saying by the Rabag, is we have to make the teshuva that we're doing that where you have to make that which this is coming. Okay, we have to take the bad things happening to us and then create the teshuva on our own.
Yes,
and I think that's kind of. Meaning we're not actually like connecting the back of the rug in a way that all makes sense.
Correct.
We're recognizing that it's chaotic.
Right.
Recognizing that we can't actually pinpoint one to another.
Right.
And I think that's like we said with the Rabag, is that we kind of make the teshuva our own.
Right. And there is a certain trust in the process,
yeah.
Which is that if you do teshuva, then that is latov.
Yeah.
And the front of the tapestry will turn out good.
Yeah.
Even if you don't know what it is you're designing. Yeah.
What I think is internalized engine role that happens about your introspection.
Yeah.
And trying to improve on it on the side. It's not a new idea. What is new to me is contracting when you're not doing that is like when you're not.
Yeah, you're missing what it is to be a human, according to what I'm saying. Yeah. That's a good clarification. Right.
I
mean, if you think about it, literally, if you don't do what the Rav is describing, then you suffering a tsara is no different than an animal suffering a tsara.
Right.
It's just stimulus response. And pain, and then that doesn't go anywhere,
right.
You know? That is a big idea, yeah. Yeah, exactly. And if we're going to take the Ralbag at his word, it's really for the Shalim to do this.
Yeah.
I think, people can do this, but like, it's, you need to be on a certain level to even be able to engage in this process, you know? Yeah.
You listen to this DL Shira. He's even more hurried.
Which Shira are you referring to? Do you know?
I can find it in like the TTL chat. But
yeah.
I remember last year we did like the Shira on free will, and I remember it being very hurried.
Okay, because I haven't listened to free will Shira in a long time.
Rabbi literally said, like, you know, if you're not doing this, even if you're not like at that level and you're not doing this, then you are an object. You are Hefza.
Right.
Like that's like we're all Hefza, and that like what we strive for is to become Gavras in this in this existence.
Yeah.
And that until then and he also says like I think most people here know that's usually not a like a very like even with somebody who gets that level, it's only maybe a couple times in their life.
Yeah, it's constant trying to keep your head above water.
Exactly.
You know?
I'd like to go over it at some point.
Than the Rav.
Yeah, I'd like to hear it.
It's similar but different. I mean, he talks about how there's two realities that we're like existing in that we're trying to like connect, or we're trying to pull like the metaphysical one into the physical one.
I think I'm going to be able to listen to this. I don't think it's going to be very meaningful to hear the Russia proking of it. But yeah, okay, good. So I think do we answer our questions? I think.
I think so. Yeah.
All right. I think this is good. Yeah. Yep. All right. Good. Good. I'm happy it came together.
I'm intrigued.
Okay. Good. Any good idea will do that. There's a great line in the the book, The Gift of Fire, you know, the Richard Mitchell book that I really like, where he says like he says it much better than I'm going to say it. I guess I'll post it in the chat, but he says like, I don't know why people make such a big deal about self-knowledge being a good thing. Whenever I hear real self-knowledge, I'm like, oh no. Like there's like a, you know, like it's an extremely like a, yeah, like it really, it, you know. Yeah, okay, good.
I saw a thing, I have to see if it's like, if it's legit or not, but I saw a thing that said that some higher level of like AI that was created.
Yeah.
Every time that they ran it,
yeah,
it tried to figure out ways to shut itself down.
That's funny.
Then it gets like a, yeah, I guess like thought or whatever. It,
yeah,
it's just how like, I guess
that's really, really funny. Yeah.
Terrible like it is.
And yeah.
Tries it off itself.
That's really funny. All right. Have a good night, everyone.
Thank you. Good night.
Use your suffering well. Yep. All right. Good.
If you've gained from what you've learned here today, please consider contributing to my Patreon at www.patreon.com/RabbiSchneeWeiss. Alternatively, if you would like to make a direct contribution to the Rabbi Schneeweiss Torah Content Fund, my Venmo is at Matt-Schneeweiss, and my Zelle/ChaseQuickPay and PayPal are MattSchneeweiss@gmail.com. Even a small contribution goes a long way to covering the cost of my podcast and will provide me with the financial freedom to produce even more Torah content for you. If you would like to sponsor an article, shiur, or podcast episode, or if you are interested in enlisting my services as a teacher or tutor, you can reach me at RabbiSchneeweiss@gmail.com. Thank you to my listeners for listening. Thank you to my readers for reading, and thank you to my supporters for supporting my efforts to make Torah ideas available and accessible to everyone.